Welcome back. It's Deb Hutton, your host, for just a little bit more than an hour this afternoon. Always a pleasure to be able to sit in this chair and spend an afternoon with you. And it's an even bigger pleasure to be able to spend some time with some of our smart speakers. This afternoon, Matt Gurney, co-founder and editor of The Line, an online magazine, and he's also a columnist for TVO. Jamie Ellerton, founding partner at Kanaptist and advisor to political and business leaders. And Aaron Morrison, longtime political strategist and now principal at Morris Comms. Welcome to all of you. I'm going to try and fly by this topic pretty quickly in terms of my explanation. Pierre Polyev is out in PEI. He is doing one of his Axe the Tax events, visiting people, meeting people, talking to voters on his way back, driving through the Maritimes. He sees a protest. He says he's just heard about this protest as they're driving on the radio. It is at the Nova Scotia-New Brunswick border. It is an ongoing protest that says it will continue until the carbon tax is overturned. He gets out, he meets with the folks, he talks to them, takes pictures, etc. These protesters, according to many accounts, are very similar, if not identical, to the protesters who were very much opposed to some of the public health measures back during the pandemic. They have had this ongoing protest, and among the things you see flying in their protest are the F. Trudeau signs and the Canadian flags that became a symbol of the convoy folks in Ottawa. Matt Gurney, start with you. Your general impressions of a leader seeking to be prime minister who stops and does this, and also the prime minister's response. Justin Trudeau came out and spoke against, couched language, spoke against Polyev for stopping and referred to people having to make their own decisions about whether they're seen with certain types of people, including conspiracy theorists. There, I've done it as quickly as I can. Over to you, Matt.
2 points to make. One of them is about the judgment of Pierre Polyev. One is about the likely political effect of this. This is poor political judgment by Pierre Polyev. I have spoken to senior conservatives over the last day. My subject line on the emails was typically simply WTF. And my understanding is that this was an unplanned event, that this was a spontaneous decision that had not previously been vetted by staff, and that some of the staff who might have been in a position to vet this if they were not driving around rural the Maritime provinces might have tried to stop this from happening. I don't think anyone thinks it was a good idea. And this is the kind of bad political instinct that may be the only thing that can stop Pierre Polyev from being prime minister. I've said this before. There is one man in this country who I think could block Pierre Polyev's political ascent, and I think it's Pierre Polyev. This was bad. This was stupid. I will add this. I don't think it's going to matter. And I don't say this to dismiss this or marginalize the incident, but I do think that the broader electorate is largely disconnected from Twitter outrage cycle du jour. One of these days, something like this might kill Pierre Polyev's political aspirations. I don't think this one did.
Aaron Morrison.
I agree with all of that. I think it is not just this one bad judgment moment, and I agree that's what it was. It was an unplanned, unvetted stop. It's the number of times Pierre Polyev walked with the convoy folks who were occupying Ottawa, the number of times he poses with people who have those F. Trudeau flags, and the fact that he hasn't denounced the endorsement from Alex Jones, who is a white supremacist who denies the Sandy Hook shooting, who denies that 9/11 happened, right? He seems to have a sort of electoral plan to make sure that these folks know that he's their buddy. And I think that may matter electorally at some point when people say, look, I'm not comfortable in that camp. Those are not my friends. Those are not my people. But I think it also might matter if he, closer to election day, tries to appeal a little bit more to the center, and his friends say, what the heck, man? Where are you going? We thought you were standing with us.
Jamie Ellerton.
Yeah, I think like two things caught off the top of your Deb. One, this wasn't impromptu stops. So this wasn't something that was planned. It's I spent some time touring in a minivan with a leader of the opposition back in my day as a political staffer. And I think it's when you see a crowd that's protesting something that's popular. It's not out of the realm of possibility to me that Pierre would be like, hey guys, let's stop it and go say hi. And that obviously would be a special moment when you get to see a political leader that normally you feel pretty detached from in day-to-day life. So I think that was the political retail instincts driving this. The reason why we're talking about this today, though, is because the prime minister wants to continue to talk about this and continues to try and essentially associate the more odious aspects of U.S. political right-wing culture onto Canada's conservatives and throws these accusations at him. And wants to have that debate. I think Pierre so far has been able to thread the needle in terms of how this gets messaged. We'll see if he's able to withstand that. I don't think you're going to see Pierre Poilievre look to get into a debate on having to denounce every single person at a protest whose political views he might disagree with, because then he's never going to stop doing that. And I think Pierre Poilievre has been quite frankly strident in refusing to get sucked into those kinds of debates. And ultimately, I guess you could say it's even a bit of a form of cancel culture. And so until I think the Liberals up their game, this is something they've been screaming at him now for the better part of 18 months. This is just the latest page in the ongoing chapter of their attempts to make this a thing. And so far, it's not sticking.
Leger Research, a week after the federal budget was brought down last Tuesday, has done some research into what Canadians think as a general impression of the budget. I think all of us could agree as political watchers that the feds put a lot of time and effort and thought into the rollout of their budget. They certainly dominated the airwaves. The results, however, though, I'm going to go back to you, Matt Gurney, I can't imagine are very positive ones for the government, given how much they put into the budget. Almost half of Canadians, according to this Leger poll, have a negative opinion of the budget. Only 21% have a positive. And interestingly, a third don't know. Your thoughts, Matt?
Sounds about right to me. I was confessing on Twitter earlier today that the day of the budget, a friend of mine in Ottawa, a long-serving Politico, had told me, I think the Liberals think they've done really well on this one, but I don't think they actually have. And he said, I think they've miscalculated how this one is going to land. I was agnostic on that. I don't pretend to have a great vibe for how the people in Ottawa are feeling. So I kind of said to him, hey, let's wait and see. Like, let's wait a couple of weeks and we'll see what the polls say. But I will say one thing that I think he was bang on about. First of all, I think as the polls firm up, at best, the Liberals have not improved. At worst, to your point, this Leger poll is bad news for them on the budget front, with him to have turned off more people than they appealed to or were simply ignoring them. I also think they're spending a lot more time and energy on capital gains than they expected. I don't think they targeted this program well. I especially don't think they communicated it well. That seems to be the big takeaway issue from this budget, and I don't think it's a winner for them.
Aaron Morrison.
Totally agree with Matt Gurney. I think this budget was really Trudeau's Hail Mary pass. And instead of throwing the ball, he tried to run it up the middle and it didn't work. It looked very promising in the weeks before the budget. His pre-budget tour looked pretty good. He was controlling the media cycle a little bit and finally getting some clean hits. And budget day, it just fell flat. It fell so flat. Only Trudeau could cook up a $40 billion deficit and still not make people happy with where he's spending the money. With this, you have to imagine the Liberals are now wondering, can Trudeau take us to the next election? Is he the guy, or is this our moment to look elsewhere for a leader heading into the next election?
Jamie, apologies. I've got about 30 seconds for you on this topic.
30 seconds. One, I'm not surprised you've not seen this move. The Liberals are so far down in the polls. I think the most charitable thing you could say is they've stopped falling. And this budget, this isn't a government that's been perceived to have said the right things now for the past 9 years, but they can't deliver the results. So I think if the sign of life that they actually are taking their political fortune seriously and trying to turn things around, it'll actually be following through on these things. That housing does get built, you start to see issues like affordability addressed. Until that happens, I think this is all just shuffling the chairs on the deck of the Titanic.
Matt Gurney, Jamie Ellerton, Aaron Morrison, they will be with us after the break. I'm actually going to key in on one particular piece of the budget that I thought was good news, but I'm hearing it's not. You're listening to Deb Hutton. This is The Rush on News Talk 1010. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining me this afternoon. I'm Deb Hutton here for the next hour and a little bit before we turn it over to our friends at the CTV News at 6. But right now I have three friends to break down the big stories of the day for before you, Matt Gurney, co-founder and editor of The Line, an online magazine, and he's also a columnist for TV Ontario. Jamie Ellerton, founding partner at Kanaptist and advisor to political and business leaders. And Aaron Morrison, longtime political strategist and now principal at Morris Comms. I said I would bring you a specific example of the federal budget that I actually applauded the feds for doing. Yes, I said good things about the federal liberals. And this specific piece was that you could include your rental payments as part of developing your credit score. They should and could go forward so that people who are renters could get that score that helps them ultimately, we hope, get a mortgage, et cetera. Apparently, that's not as popular as I thought it might be. And we have a number of tenants' advocates coming out and saying, no, 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 this shouldn't be included. Tenants should be able to opt out of having their rental payment history become part of their score. I actually can't believe this, but maybe I'm out of touch. I'll say I took calls on it earlier today, Matt Gurney, and our callers were split 50-50 on this. I thought it was a good idea.
I thought it was too, but as soon as I read about the fact that it could be hurting your credit score, I immediately went, huh. And I confess, guys, that's a blind spot for me. It's been, God, how long has it been since I've been a renter? I mean, I'm trying to think how long I've been married now plus two. So I guess I haven't been a renter for like 16 or 17 years. I've just been doing what a lot of Canadians are doing, millions of us. I plug away every month and I own a little bit more of my house. And I hope to one day realize the benefit of that house having become more valuable. But being a renter is not something I've had to worry about in a long time. And I guess I have a bit of a blind spot here, because until I thought about the credit score cutting the other way, I confess, guys, it just had not occurred to me.
Aaron Morrison, I mean, I think lenders and banks should know if you have a history of not paying your monthly rent.
Yeah, I also kind of liked this idea when I heard it. It makes some sense. I mean, since, you know, we've had credit scores in Canada since the late 80s, early 90s, your credit score depends on whether or not you pay your cell phone bill. So why shouldn't it depend on whether or not you pay your rent? For me, it's not just that it cuts both ways, which I agree, it's a pretty problematic time to say that, but it's just tone deaf in terms of its timing by the Trudeau government right now, if you ask me. Interest rates are at 5%, which means mortgages are coming in quite a bit higher than that. The average home price in Ontario is like $900,000. And here in the GTA, it's like 1.2. People are buying in their 30s and 40s and even later as a result of this, not like at 24 when their parents did. So I just think Trudeau, like, it's not the credit score that's holding people back from buying a house. This is a solution to a different problem. You're not addressing the actual problem here.
Jamie Ellerton, I finally found a liberal policy I like, and now I hear it's not the best one.
I'm actually with you on this one, Deb. I think we can't let perfect be the enemy of good here. So when we look at the case for this, this will help 5 million people improve their credit scores. And not only in the context of housing, in terms of whether or not you then one day can afford a mortgage, but even if you have an unsecured line of credit, it means that line of credit rate will end up having a lower interest than, say, something like a credit card, which nowadays is at 20%. And so I think it's ultimately a net good here. And so if there are specific examples where it's bad and the system can be abused, any of the examples I've actually read are actually issues where if we actually just ran the landlord and tenant tribunal and resourced it to get quick decisions and to hold bad landlords accountable, those issues themselves would be addressed. So I don't think perfect should be the enemy of good here. We know the housing crisis isn't going to be solved by one silver magic bullet. And if helping people improve their credit scores by demonstrating their track record of paying rent for years is one thing that helps them get financing for their first place, I say go all in on it. And whatever the repercussions of that are, find other ways to do it, because 5 million Canadians could benefit from this. And that's almost 10% of the country.
So we've talked a lot in the last it's actually been more than a week now. I was going to say last number of days about what's happening in the Ontario legislature around what is appropriate to wear. Slight different issue in the federal parliament. Deputy Government House Leader Mark Gerretsen says that critics in the legislature should not be able to use the term corrupt. Most of us who follow this stuff, I think all four of us, know that you can't call your parliamentary colleague a liar, for example. You can't say a cabinet minister lied or a premier lied or prime minister lied. And now the suggestion is you can't use the word corrupt. Your thoughts, Matt Gurney?
You know what? I understand that that kind of rhetoric can be heated, and I have no doubt that it is being abused. But also, corrupt is sometimes the right word. And I don't mind a civilized demeanor and tenor in Parliament. I actually quite like that. That's how I was raised, so to speak, even though I do drop a lot of F-bombs. So I guess not all the good parenting stuck. But I will just say in general, if you want to have decorum in the House, that's fine. But sometimes the government does get caught with its hand in the cookie jar. And sometimes there are worthy allegations of things that do rise to the level of either criminal or at least political corruption, and we should be able to say as much.
Now, I'll push it back just slightly before I move on here, Matt, but also sometimes ministers lie, and we can't say that.
Oh, perish the thought. No, I will not hear of that. No, look, and, you know, I think we have a long, proud parliamentary history of telling people to go get bent because they're lying in florid and rhetorical and complimentary ways. I can live with that. I don't think we should be further restricting the words, but I don't mind the gentlemanly way of calling that other bastard a liar.
Aaron Morrison, your thoughts.
I think this just reflects so poorly on Gerritsen, honestly, coming out and saying, well, okay, let's not worry about who is and isn't corrupt. Let's worry about whose feelings you hurt when you use that word. This is so unflattering for the Liberals. Over time, parliamentary convention has banned hundreds of words from legislatures across the country. Some of them are hilarious, some of them not so much. To start getting now into words that are, you know, occasionally true, and I would say usually used with caution by opposition politicians, I think it's a silly season, and it makes Gerritsen look like a whiner.
Last word to you, Jamie Ellerton.
At the risk of offending child birthday party entertainers and those in the circus, Mark Gerritsen is one of the biggest clowns in Parliament today. So to see him come forward with this level of pearl clutching is absurd in the extreme.
All right. The accusation of corruption lives for this panel. Thanks so much for joining me. As usual, I don't get through as many topics as I could or should, but appreciate your thoughts. Matt Gurney, co-founder and editor of The Line and columnist for TV Ontario. Jamie Ellerton, founding partner at Kanaptist and advisor to political and business leaders. And Aaron Morrison, longtime political strategist and now principal at Morrison Comms. Thank you all for your insights and for sharing them with us this afternoon. Coming up after the break for news, I'm going to tell you I read a story in the CP24 website, made my blood boil. It is about a repeat offender, the lines of things this individual has done. So we're bringing in a criminal defense lawyer to explain how this is even remotely possible. You're listening to Deb Hutton. This is The Rush on News Talk 1010.